Good evening. It is Tuesday, February 25th, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, there are two conflicting portraits of Julian Assange that are being presented at his extradition hearing. The U.S., who wants to try Assange here in the United States on espionage charges, the U.S. says that he's an ordinary criminal whose publication of hundreds of thousands of secret military documents a decade ago put many people at risk of torture and death. Assange's lawyers counter with the position that the WikiLeaks publisher was being victimized by a lawless U.S. government that wants to make an example of him. Let's go to Woolwich Crown Court in Southeast London and Loud and Clear producer Walter Schmolerik for insight into what happened in the second day of Julian Assange's extradition hearing. Walter, as always, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So let me ask first, was my introduction a fairly succinct description of the two angles or the two positions that the prosecution and defense are taking here?
Yeah, that's correct. So yesterday it was the U.S. attorneys, the U.S. prosecutors' turn. They were making the case, as you laid out, that Julian Assange is just a criminal, right? This isn't a political case. It's straightforward. This is about law enforcement. And what Julian Assange did and what WikiLeaks did by publishing this information was put people's lives at risk, right? They claimed that there were sources, allies, informants, you know, the people who supplied the United States with some of the information that turns up in those documents. And they basically implied that some of those people were killed because of it. Now, today was Julian Assange's lawyer's turn, right? They were sort of in the driver's seat, making their argument and taking apart the prosecution. Well, you know, really the side seeking his extradition's argument. And so what they were making, I mean, many points, of course, throughout the day. But, you know, the basic thrust of it was that, you know, no, this is journalism. There's not a single person who was, you know, who we can conclusively say was harmed, much less killed as a consequence of WikiLeaks' publication of this, of these documents, which is something that the U.S. government, by the way, actually already has admitted in Chelsea Manning's trial. And furthermore, they were making the point today that it wasn't just WikiLeaks either that was involved in publishing these. I mean, WikiLeaks was the news organization that received the documents first, but, you know, it was set of such a tremendous volume. You know, the diplomatic cables, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, you know, in the case of the cables, you know, they engaged in basically a consortium with several other major news outlets, you know, including the New York Times, El País in Spain, to go through and redact these documents and to kind of jointly publish them and bring them to the public light. So, you know, why WikiLeaks is being singled out, you know, also is kind of, you know, it's an even weaker case in light of those facts. And the unredacted versions, right, the ones that, you know, allegedly, and in fact, we know this is not true, led to people being harmed. Those were released not because of WikiLeaks, but because of the actions of a journalist of the Guardian, in fact, you know, publishing the password to this mirror site in one of their books. So yeah, I mean, it was a pretty thorough deconstruction of the U.S. government's case that's gonna continue as the week goes on.
I want to go back to a point that you just made in your very, very clear explanation. And we also touched on it yesterday, because I think that this point gets to the hypocrisy of so much of what's playing out here. James, and we talked about this yesterday, but again, I just want to reiterate this point. James Lewis, lawyer for the U.S., speaking on behalf of the U.S., said hundreds of people across the world had to be warned after the WikiLeaks disclosures. Some had to be relocated. Others later disappeared. Although he said the United States would not try to prove that was directly a result of the disclosures. That admission to me in court, I don't wonder why after he said that, the judge didn't just say, well, let's close the books on this now and let's all go out for lunch. Because you're making these incredible allegations and then you say, but I'm not going to try to prove them. So I just wanted to reiterate that because we did touch on it yesterday, but I just find that to be so telling. And I'm wondering why after an admission like that, somebody in the United States isn't just screaming. I mean, why isn't Chris Matthews just screaming about this incredible contradiction?
It's a huge contradiction. It's unbelievable. It's actually an admission that, like we were saying, they had already made. So the fact that it even got to this point is clear proof of what Julian Assange's lawyers have been arguing all week, that this is a political trial, that Julian Assange is being put on trial for political reasons. And therefore, under the extradition agreement between the U.S. and the U.K., the U.K. is not obligated to extradite him, to meet the U.S. request for extradition. But of course, there's a long history. Oh, and, by the way, on that note, there's something I learned from one of the protesters today that, the supporters of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks actually wrote a letter to the Queen, saying, hey, this is unjust. Like, can you please say something about it, to use your moral authority? And her staffers or whatever wrote back and they were just like, oh, sorry, we can't do that. The Queen doesn't involve herself in political matters like these. She leaves that to her ministers. So and I'm sure they wrote that not knowing that, really undercuts the whole legal argument here. But I mean, it's like anybody who's thinking about this semi honestly knows that this is obviously a political move by the U.S. government.
Doesn't she open and close Parliament? Doesn't she have a huge seat, a big chair in Parliament?
That's true.
And she comes in and they put a big crown on her head and she sits there and says, hello. So, isn't that true?
Yeah, okay. Totally.
But she doesn't get involved in politics.
Oh, no, she can't get involved in politics. But it's just like, everybody, like, how can... What like thinking person can possibly think that this isn't a political trial? Like the news organization that revealed, perhaps the greatest exposure of U.S. government secrets in history, the prosecution of the guy who's in charge of that organization, like, yes, that is political. Of course, that's political. This is, a case like Julian Assange is a political prisoner right now, and he's being treated horribly, by the way, by prison authorities.
Well, in fact, let's get to that. According to The Guardian, he was handcuffed 11 times, stripped naked twice, and had his case files confiscated after the first day of the extradition hearing, according to his lawyers, who complained of interference in his ability to take part in his defense. Are these some of the explosive charges that you referred to yesterday when you said that when the defense gets the chance to present their case, that there are a number of explosive revelations that are going to be made?
Well, that was WikiLeaks sort of teased that. I think it remains to be seen exactly what they were talking about.
Okay.
But, this is certainly important. Yeah, so what happened last night, according to Julian Assange's lawyers, this is certainly consistent with how the UK authorities have been acting throughout the whole course of this ordeal. Assange's legal documents were confiscated from him by the prison guards. He was also shuffled around to,
five different cells.
Yeah, exactly. Handcuffed, stripped naked. All this, like you laid out, all of this harassment. And it's obviously meant to prohibit him from playing a meaningful role in his own legal defense. And his lawyers in court today raised that to the judge. The judge essentially just shrugged and was like, oh, well, that sounds bad, but, not my problem. I'm not in charge of the prison. You should take that up with the prison authorities.
Yeah, I couldn't understand her, and some of this might be my having less of a clear understanding of the relationship between judges and jails in Britain as opposed to judges and jails here. But for her to say, call the prison, don't call me, I found that to be incredibly odd.
Yeah, it is pretty odd. I mean, maybe there's some intricacy of the British legal system that we're missing here, but it certainly strikes me as very odd. I mean, isn't she supposed to be in charge of what goes on? I mean, isn't that kind of the job of a judge?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So, you know, I think it's pretty consistent. Like nobody wants to take primary responsibility for something that's so blatantly unfair, like, you know, like what they did to Julian Assange last night. But they're all clearly not that bothered by it, right? I mean, this is sort of a setup.
What about this discussion, his attorney's claim that the U.S. wanted to kill him and make it look like an accident, that American spies teamed up with UC Global, a Spanish company contracted by Ecuador to provide security at the embassy? There seems to have been a lot of discussion about either kidnapping him, which I think you touched on earlier, or actually trying to kill him.
Yes. So this is very bizarre. I mean, it was certainly one of the more interesting things that happened today. So right. So one of the maneuvers the United States government pulled against Julian Assange was that they essentially enlisted, recruited, cajoled, you know, however it went down, the Spanish company that was, you know, providing security technology to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian Assange was, you know, holed up as an asylum seeker for years prior to him being arrested. And so they were sort of on the U.S.'s side now. They were providing the United States with, you know, all this surveillance footage of Julian Assange. And they were apparently just in sort of, I guess, like a brainstorming session with some U.S., you know, U.S. officials. And at some point during those discussions, one of the representatives of the U.S. government actually raised the possibility of poisoning Julian Assange. I mean, I guess of assassinating Julian Assange. I mean, the idea that this was even on the table, right, even if there wasn't sort of an operational plan to do it, shows to the great lengths, the unbelievably immoral and illegal lengths the U.S. government will go to silence Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
There was also a discussion today that Assange tried to contact then Secretary of State Clinton after he realized that unredacted diplomatic documents were going to be leaked onto the internet almost 10 years ago. And that apparently the State Department just told him, can you call back later?
Yeah. So that's true. That was something that I think was a very strong point made today in Julian Assange's defense. Yesterday the U.S. government presented this timeline basically of, you know, how the release of this information is thought to have happened. And it was full of inaccuracies. And so now, you know, today, Assange's lawyers were deconstructing that. And they were making this point, you know, that detail came out in the course of them making the point that, like, look, like, we were very responsible, right, as a media organization in terms of how we put this information out there. You know, the unredacted cables, that wasn't us. And in fact, when we realized that that was going to come out, we immediately tried to talk to the U.S. government, and they didn't seem to care that much at the time.
Assange's lawyer told the court that, again, he called the State Department and said, unless we do something, people's lives are put at risk. Now, I found it interesting. That sword can cut two ways. One, it can be, hey, look, I called Secretary of State Clinton, and y'all, you know, told me to call back in a couple hours, and I told you that people's lives could be put at risk. That's one thing to applaud Julian Assange for being responsible and giving everybody a heads up. But the other, to me, side of that sword is, well, you were either putting people's lives at risk or you weren't. And now you're saying you didn't, but here you made a phone call saying that you could. So that, to me, is some treacherous waters to try to navigate.
Yeah, I could see how, you know, maybe the U.S. attorneys would try to turn that one around on him. I think he has a pretty solid defense if they do. I mean, one, there's a difference between, like, could and did, right?
You know, absolutely. Like,
so you know, John Kiriakou actually was making this point too earlier, that, you know, Tom Drake, who was another famous whistleblower, you know, whenever people confronted him with, oh, you have blood on your hands, he would always say, what's their name, right? Because nobody, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just this trope. But, and the other thing, though, is that, you know, if anybody is to be held accountable for any harm, I mean, there was no harm that we can say definitively happened. But if it had, you know, the blame for that would likely have been, I mean, would rightfully be on the person who leaked the password to this mirror that exists. And the reason why there was a website with the unredacted cables that you needed a passport or a password to enter is because, you know, basically right after it came out that the WikiLeaks had this material, their site was the subject of a cyber attack. I mean, you know, you can speculate as to who that would be. Certainly the US government would have had an interest in waging some kind of cyber operation against WikiLeaks. And so basically to safeguard this information, they created this mirror site. And that's where, you know, when the password came out, that's how all this unredacted material became public.
I want to go back to this discussion quick. I just want to make another point about UC Global and the discussions about killing Assange. It came out apparently through the Daily Mail that U.S. Global's owner, David Morales, was exposed by a mysterious Iberian whistleblower known as Witness 2. Mm-hmm. And that Witness 2 revealed that Morales said the Americans were desperate and had even suggested more extreme measures could be applied against the guest, Assange, to put an end to the situation. This came out in court. And I know that gets back to the conversation about possibly poisoning him. But these all seemed, in my opinion, seem to be data points that when put together would say to the British, they've been trying to kill this guy for a very long time. We cannot send him back to the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And his life is absolutely still at risk if he is extradited, even though the United States said, promised, like, we will not seek the death penalty, right? Because that's, you know, that's considered to be cruel and unusual punishment. Like, that could be grounds for the denial of an mm-hmm. extradition request. Because, I think most countries, that's considered to be the case. So, you know, not only were they thinking about just assassinating him before, apparently, the defense lawyers, Julian Assange's lawyers, also have made the case, I believe they said this yesterday, not today, but they said that, you know, Julian Assange is also at risk of suicide, right? He's a suicide risk because he's been psychologically tortured so badly. His mental state has been degraded so much that, you know, if he is extradited to the United States where he's facing unbelievable charges, 17 counts of espionage, one count of computer hacking, you know, altogether 175 years in prison, you know, that could also lead to his suicide.
Gotcha. So in wrapping up, what did you walk away from today's trial having a clearer sense of how this could go based upon what the defense has started to put forth? Are you able to formulate any opinions on this?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's still a lot to go. I mean, both this week and then it'll pick up again in May. I'd be a little cautious of making too many predictions, but I mean, it is certainly cause for concern, you know, how the judge reacted to the news of Julian Assange's, well, the clear interference by prison authorities and Julian Assange's ability to defend himself or contribute to his own defense. That's not a great sign. But, you know, again, the grassroots protest outside is still going strong. Mm-hmm. Internationally, there's also been action. So, you know, there's pressure on the other side, too.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, Walter Schmolerig joining us from London. Thank you. Thank you very much, as always, for your wonderful work. Joining us from Woolwich Crown Court in Southeast London and producer of Loud and Clear. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Hey, man. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
See you later.
All right. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Mike Bloomberg prepares media onslaught against Democratic frontrunner Bernie Sanders. Bloomberg's presidential campaign plans to unleash its cash-flush media operation against Bernie Sanders in the wake of the Vermont senator's resounding victory in the Nevada caucus. With Bloomberg making this move and U.S. mainstream outlets like MSNBC and CNN engaging in a misinformation campaign on their own, Senator Sanders has quite a challenge ahead of him. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. As always, David, welcome back.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
You know, as I'm watching this play out, to a certain degree, Bernie seems to be up against the opposite of what Trump received in 2016. Leslie Moonves, the then CBS executive chairman and CEO, said about Trump, "It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? The money's rolling in, and this is fun. That's what Les Moonves said in 2016. So CBS and other outlets gave Trump all types of free time, while now the knives are out and being sharpened against Bernie in mainstream media. Your thoughts on that assessment?
You're exactly correct. I've actually saw some studies that pointed out in 2016 that Donald Trump got in excess of $1 billion U.S. dollars in terms of free advertising from the major networks. I mean, that's an incredible amount of bump that he received. Conversely, what we're seeing now, up until recently with Bernie Sanders, was either no coverage whatsoever, which was consistent with what happened 4 years ago, or now they're all piling on Bernie Sanders in terms of trying to attack him or sort of basically deny his legitimacy or question what's going on. And so you're right. It's maybe not the direct opposite, but certainly in some ways a reverse of the coverage where Trump got a free ride. And now Sanders is going to get a lot of coverage now, but it's not going to be good coverage. And it's going to be constantly questioning him, much in the same way. You're right. We saw recently with CNN, MSNBC, and some of the other channels.
Bloomberg's campaign, they plan a multi-pronged attack, including the publication of opposition research on Sanders. It'll also push out digital attack ads focused on his record. Yesterday, the Bloomberg campaign, they attempted to paint Sanders as a past ally of the NRA, a group that Bloomberg has fought for over a decade. I mean, it's no holds barred now.
It is no holds barred. And Bloomberg's strategy is part of, I think, the bigger problem that the Democrats are collectively facing. If we go back to last week's Nevada debate, the defining characteristic, I think, of that debate was how everybody went after everybody, with the exception of going after Sanders or Sanders going after everybody else. The reason why I mention that is that when you walked out of there, Warren, Buttigieg, Biden, Klobuchar, Bloomberg, all of them were awfully bloodied by the debate. And what the Democrats seem to be doing at this point is attacking their rivals as a way of enriching themselves, as opposed to figuring out a way of expanding their bases in a positive way. And I think Bloomberg's doing the same thing, that you've got Sanders, who's clearly, by all measures, the front runner for the Democrats right now. And instead of running, let's say, a better campaign, providing a stronger message, instead is going to bring Sanders down. And what this does is what collectively means that the Democrats are bringing all of themselves down and making them more vulnerable in terms of trying to take on Trump in the general election.
And talk about how, and elaborate a little bit more on this. You and I were just talking about the moderates in this process, their egos don't seem to allow them to adjust their strategies, and this could wind up really damaging the Democratic brand overall.
You're correct. When we look at now Nevada results, if we look at the votes that are going for the more progressive candidates, it's about 50-55% for Sanders and Warren, and the moderates are about 45%. But we're really talking about, it's really the moderates against Sanders at this point for the most part. And there is enough, if you had one moderate, perhaps one moderate could emerge who could be a real serious rival to Bernie Sanders. But instead, we've got several of them. Again, we've got, like I said, Biden, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Bloomberg. They're all scraping for the moderate vote, which means many of them are not getting the 15% that you needed for, let's say, threshold requirements in Nevada, and they're dividing themselves up. And at some point, you have to think that at least one or two, if not three of them, have to step out if they want a moderate to get the nomination so that the other moderate can consolidate. But each one of them has too big of an ego. Biden, Bloomberg, again, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, each are probably thinking, well, I'm the most viable candidate. The other one should drop out. So while it's in the moderates' collective interest for several others to drop out, it's in each person's individual interest for that not to happen. The result is what? Bernie Sanders is somewhat within the party getting a free ride, which is also causing the panic for the media, because if moderates can't bring him down, maybe the corporate media has to do its job in terms of bringing him down.
I've been saying for quite a while that I thought that Bloomberg was really the fair-haired child of the DNC and that they really want a brokered convention where they can then assign the superdelegates to Bloomberg in a second ballot. Do you see that as logical? And if so, do you see that as still being a possible plan?
Well, I think it's emerging as a possible plan. I think it is for the leadership, more moderate wing of the Democratic Party that does not want Sanders to get the nomination. What I think they're hoping is that, for example, starting on Super Tuesday, where 34% of all the votes or delegates are up for stake, if Bloomberg can start to rack up some, even if he can't win the nomination, and going forward with all his money, all his resources, he can keep what? Getting enough to prevent Sanders from winning it on the first round. If Sanders can't win it on the first round, superdelegates kick in, they get to vote. And I think at that point, I don't think we're going to see Biden or Buttigieg or Klobuchar as the obvious rivals. Bloomberg becomes the obvious person at that point, because what? He's going to have however many billions of dollars in the bank that he's prepared to spend. And so I thought also for the last few weeks that Bloomberg was kind of what the great hope for the Democratic Party, that he brings the resources to help. The problem, of course, was last week, what? A horrible debate performance. But there's already indications in the polls that the public has forgotten that horrible performance. And maybe if Bloomberg keeps his mouth shut in debates, that his popularity will go up.
Let's shift gears here quickly. Massive changes to California voting are sparking fears of an Iowa-style primary chaos. California they passed the 2016 state law known as the Voter Choice Act, aimed at making voting easier and more flexible. So you have a number of things that they're doing in California. They're introducing new digital voting machines. They're allowing more people and encouraging more people to vote by mail. They're closing some polling places, but opening and enlarging others. Your thoughts on what California is trying to do? They even now have, with their electronic voting machines, those voting machines don't tally the vote. That voting machine kicks out a what? Paper receipt that the voter can check, confirm, and then put in to be tabulated. California seeming to be what some would say on the cutting edge of changing voting in the country.
Perhaps all these ideas are good, but I think the one message we learned from Iowa is that you don't roll out all of these changes unless you've tested and trained the people to be able to administer these new technologies or techniques, and unless you prepare, let's say, the voters. And that's the worry here, is that I don't see much in terms of California having learned any of those lessons. Mm-hmm. And it's possible, and it's of course possible, that they get away with it, no big deal. But on the other hand, given the fact of how large the state is, how many people are going to be casting ballots there, and of course, the number of delegates that are at stake, there is this serious concern about how the tabulation, the voting, and all that is going to play out. And so we all are kind of looking to see what part of the story California is. Is it going to be another Iowa? Is it going to be maybe closer to New Hampshire? We just don't know at this point in terms of what it's going to look like. But it's going to be one of multiple stories that come out next Tuesday and next Wednesday, again, when we've got all these 14 different states that are casting ballots.
What one of the things that's interesting to me in terms of what California is implementing, and they're not implementing this across the entire state, counties have the option to opt in or not. But again, one of the things that we've been told for years, you can't have a paper ballot. You can't get a paper receipt from an electronic voting machine, allowing people to vote by mail, adding days to the process. So now early in-person voting at some of the facilities in California started on the 22nd of February. Voting centers are offering same-day registration, even on Election Day. Voters are not going to be tied to a single polling place near their home. They can cast ballots at any voting center in the county. This really seems to be expanding the electorate by making it easier for people to vote than contracting the electorate, which seems to have been the objective of both parties in this country for a very long time.
It has been. For the two parties, it has been about what? Mobilize your base, demobilize the other side, and hope that either the swing voters vote for you or at the very least you scare them away and they don't vote for the opposition. So I think you're exactly on score here. And California is taking the radical approach that says maybe we ought to have more people vote. And I'm in the state of Minnesota, for example. There are some things that California is adopting that we're doing, for example. You know, we've been doing for years in Minnesota, day of election registration, making it easier if you can't prove that you live in the district to have like a neighbor come in and vouch for you to say you live in this district, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are a variety of things that we know that actually do work in terms of making it easier for people to vote. Again, the idea of saying, let's also make it more convenient, maybe have it done at shopping centers, maybe you're driving on the way from home. All this, I think, is trying to bring voting into the 21st century. But I'm also going to mention that having the paper ballot, people are saying, that doesn't sound like 21st century. No, that sounds like a lesson that should have been learned from Florida 2000, is that at the end of the day, having a paper receipt or something that you can verify that can be counted, I think is an important aspect of voting, because if we're concerned about what? Hacking. If we're concerned about whoever it may be trying to compromise the integrity of our voting systems, having that paper ballot backup becomes important in terms of addressing that issue.
What if we told people, When you get that paper receipt, put it on your refrigerator the same way you would put your lottery ticket on the refrigerator. Hold it for a week in case we do need to recount these votes. What about that as an incredibly novel idea?
It's one of several great ideas of perhaps improving election returns, or it might look good next to your kids, you know, picture of a duck on the refrigerator. I'm not sure which it would be.
Depends on how good of an artist that your kid is and what that duck looks like.
Of course.
Professor, just real quick, about 30 seconds. Do you think that Bloomberg's overwhelming wealth will be able to offset his underwhelming policy positions up to this point?
It's going to help him quite a bit, because at the end of the day, as they say, if money is speech and if money talks, it might be a situation here where money speaks louder than in public policy.
Gotcha.
We know that's been true in the United States for years.
Professor David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. As always, David, thank you so much for your time. Look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's a great, great piece in Mint Press by Darius Shatamasebi. It's entitled 2021 Pentagon Budget Requests, Hints at Russia and China as the New Focus of U.S. Empire. The Pentagon recently announced its fiscal 2021 budget request at $705 billion. It indicates a shifting focus from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and a greater emphasis on the types of weapons that could be used to confront nuclear giants like Russia and China. What signals does this send going forward? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst. He is Mark Sloboda. Mark, as always, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the Critical Hour.
Let's start with just your overall thoughts on this headline before we get into the details of the article.
Okay, so first of all, it's really no surprise. This is long in coming. The last national security strategy, the defense strategy for the United States, which defines its military posture, indicated quite clearly a shift from what had been a focus on counter-terrorist and counter-insurgency operations across the Middle East and North Africa, stretching all the way from Libya to Afghanistan, that the U.S. was trying to shift away towards that because it saw an increasing threat of competition from other great powers, what it defines as peer competitors or near peer competitors. And principally, it means Russia and China there. And this has been defined in U.S. National security documents. But even larger, I mean, if you go all the way back even to the Obama administration, he was initiating this even then with his pivot to Asia, as it was called. It didn't quite go down the way he planned because he got himself involved in disastrous regime change operations in Libya and Syria, and he didn't get quite the pivot he wanted. But the U.S. pivot to Asia is all about military. It's about Navy and containment of China, as it seems, and forming an anti-China alliance for what the Pentagon brass, geopolitical thinkers, are on the record multiple times as saying they regard as an inevitability in the near to medium future of a military conflict with China, not off the coast of the United States, not in Hawaii, but off of China's coast in the South China Sea or the Taiwanese Straits. And the U.S. has been working towards this for a long time. It's in the national security strategy. It's in the nuclear posture review. And this is just one more foundation laid towards that effort and the focus in U.S. Military and imperial efforts laid down in the hardest form of them all, hard cash.
Let me see if I can formulate this question succinctly. So in this anti-China posture, I find it interesting that China with the Belt and Road Initiative and also China having this win-win strategy, and win-win is something that they've articulated that they try to engage in. Is it naive of me to think that the United States and China could actually peacefully coexist in pursuit of this win-win strategy? Or is this the United States as an imperialist hegemon just refusing to do anything cooperative with anybody and just continuing along the same imperialist mindset that has made America, America? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Okay.
And, it is, I believe, perfectly possible for the U.S. And China and Russia and others to go on relatively peacefully coexisting as competitors in the economic sphere, mm-hmm. and keeping a watchful eye on each other in the military without devolving to conflict. If the United States gave up on its long standing foreign policy priority of pursuing U.S.-led global military hegemony and primacy in all spheres, military foremost among them, but others.
Okay.
And this, you know, continuation of this intent makes that coexistence possible. International affairs thinkers always go back to this realist international relations theory known as the Thucydides trap, going back to the ancient Greek thinker. We see a declining would-be hegemon, the U.S., facing a rising great power. And basically the doctrine says that unless one is willing to give way and cede alignment to the other, or you know, give up this pursuit of global power in the case of the U.S. as the declining hegemon, at least in relative terms, then confrontation they regard as impossible to avoid, because they're simply unwilling to view the world in any type of win-win, you know, economic coexistence, you know, cooperating on climate change as the biggest problem facing us all type way of thinking about the future international political sphere.
Help me decipher this wording that came out of this great piece, 2021 Pentagon Budget Request Hints at Russia and China as a New Focus. To use the Pentagon's exact wording, the U.S. is seeking to procure more advanced high-end weapon systems, which provide increases standoff, enhanced lethality, and autonomous targeting for employment against near-peer threats in a more contested environment.
Yeah. No. Okay, so you know that's a lot of verbiage there, but I think it's pretty easy to see through it.
Right.
They're talking about very expensive, very high-tech hardware, not the sort of hardware that you use to kill counterinsurgents with semi-automatic weapons running through the brush, or with, you know, drone strikes against, you know, undefended targets.
This made me think about the hypersonic missile systems and the Space Force.
That's you got two out of three of the big increases, in particular in the research and the initial development budgets. And one of the third one is indeed the U.S. Space Force. The second of those is hypersonic weapons and hypersonic weapons defense. But the first of those is artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles.
Okay.
And that is actually the biggest increase in what is a kind of record for the included in the Pentagon budget for research and development, not just on, you know, pure research of artificial intelligence, but how to use artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles on the battlefield of the near future. And this is something that, of course, that not just the United States is working on, but the United States, China, Russia, the EU, and even, you know, big regional powers, India, Turkey, and others. They're all pursuing weapons that would allow them to react faster than a normal human would in these circumstances.
And so at the heart of that is 5G.
Yeah, well, 5G is a part of that. Mm-hmm. Although what we think of as, commercial networks for these systems will be quite separate from hardened military systems, which will require a much higher degree of security and separated firewall systems for these type of things. But certainly there are a large number of communication satellites specifically for military use, and others that get dual military and commercial use, specifically focused on this. Yes.
And folks should not become confused in thinking that the U.S.-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are over. And, let me read this from Darius Shatamasebi's piece. He says, this is not to say that the U.S.-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq will end. During 2019, the U.S. dropped a whopping 7,423 munitions on Afghanistan, the highest number of bombs released in nearly a decade of its ongoing war and occupation there. According to the DOD, a two-pronged approach will see the U.S. ensuring that, quote, U.S. worldwide munition inventories are sufficiently stocked for ongoing needs. In layman's terms, the budget will account for the ongoing wars in the Middle East. Two things there, or a couple of things there. Reading this article in the context of the Washington Post Afghanistan papers, where it was clearly explained that we have no idea what we're doing. When you read this article in that context, it just makes you wonder, where is the American outcry that we're going to spend $705 billion in efforts to fight things that we may not even really have a clear understanding of who the enemy is, what the enemy plans to do, and how we would need to develop defenses against it?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you put it in the context of the U.S., which, of course, is the world's largest military spender with this $705 billion base defense budget, mm-hmm. which is a $67 billion increase over the year before. But when you add in all of the things like overseas contingency operations, which is basically all the wars that the U.S. fights around the world, the Veteran Affairs budget, Homeland Security, nuclear weapons activity is actually included under the Department of Energy spending, and the U.S. is having a big increase. You know, Trump is furthering a $1 trillion effort to upgrade and expand the U.S. Nuclear arsenal, including the new focus on call them low yield or more usable mm-hmm. nuclear weapons that the U.S. and the Pentagon intends to use on the battlefield of the future rather than just as strategic weapons. You add that all these other things in together, and the real amount of money flowing in to the Pentagon for the purpose of military and defense just even a couple years ago was $1.25 trillion a year. But even that $705 billion base budget is more than 10 times what Russia is spending, and the other non-U.S. NATO allies also spend another four times Russia's defense budget. Russia is actually only the fourth largest military spender in the world. It's the U.S., and then you have a big, huge drop down to about $181 billion with China. And then number three is actually Saudi Arabia, another U.S. ally. And in fact, if you take a look at the top 15 military spenders in the world and you take out Russia and China, the rest of them are all U.S. allies and partners.
And they're buying stuff from us.
Yeah. What does the U.S. need this incredible military budget for? Well, dominating the world. I mean, global hegemony. That's the real purpose of it. It's not enough for the U.S. to defend itself. It has to have complete military primacy over everyone else. And every country, independent country with a foreign policy, has to think of its own defense. And its own military allows it a certain amount of sovereignty. And when you pursue primacy to the extent the U.S. is, you are forcing an arms race and forcing military conflict on other countries like Russia and China in this way. And as we saw, the U.S. isn't pivoting out of the Middle East. It's talking about getting out of Afghanistan. It's talking about cutting deals with the Taliban. But the U.S. has been talking about that for over a decade now. And we're looking at the longest conflict in U.S. history. And as you rightly noted, the U.S. dropped more bombs on Afghanistan last year than any time before over the course of the last 10 years. And the U.S. Trump talks about pulling troops out of the Middle East. There's actually more troops in the Middle East than there was when he took office. There's no indication that he's actually reduced troop totals in Syria. He's just shifted them down and changed the contingent around to different types of troops and vehicles. And now he's pouring thousands of U.S. troops into Saudi Arabia and also into Iraq in escalating tensions with Iran. So there's no indication that the U.S. is toning down. And this trying to pursue great power, you know, conflict, increasing numbers, thousands of troops on Russia's border, this Pacific containment sphere around China, the ongoing long wars of terror across the Middle East and North Africa, the U.S. is facing imperial overstretch in a big way. And you add that onto the U.S. has lost, the Pentagon admitted that they just misplaced $715 million worth of arms in Syria. Probably all ended up with the jihadis. Boy, how did that happen? Also, in recent years, the U.S., the Pentagon has failed two audits, and they simply can't account for $21 trillion in spending. $21 trillion. That's almost the size of the U.S. total federal debt. And it's absolutely insane. The U.S. military spending is insane. It is completely out of control. It is unaccounted for, and it is pushing the U.S. Economy and the living standards of the people ever further down and down as it eats up a greater and greater share of the economy and the budget, leading to increased budget deficits and so on. And all for what? For the pursuit of, you know, absolute primacy over all other potential peer competitors that is pushing us to you know, a great power war? Is that something that's really in the American people's interest, or is that something out of Dr. Strangelove?
Well, that's one of the most important questions that I think needs to be articulated. And what you just laid out is incredibly important, because when you look at, as you mentioned earlier, the Asian pivot under Obama, then you add to that this plan to upgrade low-yield nuclear weapons so that we could actually use a nuclear weapon on the battlefield. And then you add to that the United States withdrawing from a number of these weapons agreements and treaties. This really sounds like starting under Obama, but really multiplied under Trump. The United States, to your point, is preparing for what it believes could be world domination. That, to me, is the thinking of a failing empire.
Yeah, I mean, and the thinking, it's bipartisan. I mean, there's no
arguments. Absolutely.
There's no other than possibly Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard. There's no Democrats in the House or Senate calling for a decreased military budget, calling for the removal of the authorization of military force, which the U.S. has absurdly used to justify all of its military invasions, occupation, and regime changes since 2001, 2003, even when they have absolutely nothing to do with al-Qaeda. There's no effort to rein in Trump. In fact, you know, that they're just counting that, you know, the next president will continue hegemony in a more normal fashion. So, you know, they're certainly not going to take any powers away from the president or any sort of budget away from the Pentagon. They keep piling more and more on. And, you know, the motto might as well be hegemony or bust. Mm-hmm. And bust in a big world-ending sort of way. And that's the way that the U.S. is looking at it. They look at a world where China, with a population considerably larger than the United States, that is economically more powerful than the United States, and a military that is increasingly coming close to the equal. You know, we're looking at a 10 to 20 years down the road yet. But they look at that situation as unacceptable, and they will do anything to stop it. And that's why, you know, the warfare has already begun, really. You know, the besides the containment and the little regime changes against allies on the side, we are in an economic war right now to try to reshape the global economy more in our favor. Free markets? Ha! That's nonsense. But cyber warfare, info warfare, and all of the other, you know, ways that we're looking at pursuing warfare. Artificial intelligence is going to be huge in the next few years, in the next two coming decades. It's really going to be the breakout military technology that everyone's looking for. But, you know, it's already begun.
We've gone over, and I really appreciate you giving me this incredible insight. We've got about 2 minutes left, and this was some interesting analysis that I thought came out of this article. Based on the history of U.S. military expeditions, it's safe to conclude that the U.S. will continue operations in the Middle East and North Africa and avoid war with more powerful nations such as Russia and China, as Professor Richard Jackson, director of the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies in New Zealand, told Mint Press, quote, "The history of the U.S. involves it attacking small nations with very limited capabilities in extremely asymmetric conflicts." I thought that was incredibly telling, and I hadn't thought about it in that context, but when I look at what the United States has been doing, at least during my lifetime, that's exactly, with the exception of World War II, that's how we've been playing this game. We got about a minute and a half left.
Well, sure. And to an extent, that was a feature of the Cold War, but more importantly, the post-Cold War world, where, you know, in order to shape the world hegemonic-wise to your control, your status, you start chipping away at countries that might possibly align with others. Syria is, you know, as a perfect example. Syria is a country that is allied with Iran, that is allied with Russia, that has good relations with China. So, you know, we have to take that piece of the puzzle out of the game, and hence the focus on smaller countries. But inevitably, as that gets closer and closer, you know, and as NATO moves closer and closer to U.S. borders, and this anti-Chinese containment sphere moves closer and closer, you know, to China's coast and the South China Sea, you know, the number of these small asymmetric wars and regimes that can be removed is rapidly dwindling, and they're focusing on the core countries, you know, the peer or near peer competitors now. And, you know, but at the same time, their economies and militaries are rapidly rising. And the U.S. sees a very short 10 to 15 year window to change the trajectories of their rise and its relative decline before it won't be able to assert the type of future that of total dominance that it wants to see.
Mark Sloboda, as always, man, that was some phenomenal analysis right there. Thank you so much, Mark. Really, really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.